This episode is brought to you by Zoll. Sudden cardiac death claims 40 to 45% of all low EF heart failure patients, and even the newest drug therapies don't reduce risk overnight. Learn which heart failure patients may benefit from a LifeVest wearable defibrillator during medical optimization. Visit Zoll.com/heartfailure. The ACC does not assume responsibility of content of sites external to ACC.org.
From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I'm recording this on Monday morning, September 21st. I've chosen three articles to go over today. One of them looks at changes in case volumes of a heart transplant program after changes in organ sharing and strategy generally at the institution. I wanted to look at a particular aspect of a recent scientific statement from the American Heart Association on drug-induced arrhythmias. And then finally, we'll look at biomarkers in COVID-19 and their prognostication in terms of their ability to add risk estimate. So the first came out in JAMA Network Open, and it was a retrospective analysis of a single center looking at heart transplant activities before and after restructuring back in 2018. It coincided with the UNOS heart allocation policy changes. And there were a number of changes that the program initiated, including a change in a surgical directorship, a more patient-centered approach to donor heart selection, support for a dedicated procurement surgeon, and increased surgical attending involvement at all the transplant meetings to ensure that they were doing everything they could to reach patients on their list. And over this change, the volume of the center rose from about 12 patients per year to 58 during the year after the change, and the organ acceptance rate went up from 6% to 20%. The donor age increased from 30 to 40 years. LVAD use prior to the transplant actually went down from 63% to 21%, while the use of ECMO and intra-aortic balloon pump increased from 0 to 6.9 and 17.2, and the days on the list went down from 242 days median to 41. ICU length of stay increased from 7 to 10 days, and there was no difference in the outcome at 180 days, almost 90% survival. And the article makes the point that strategic changes in donor heart selection and recipient selection and also in the structure of a program can increase the transplant volume without necessarily affecting short-term outcomes. I thought it was an interesting paper and just illustrates with a limited donor pool out there, transplant programs, you know, struggle to try to figure out how to do the best for patients and how to maximize the use of organs that they might have access to. I thought this was an interesting example of a single center making some major strategic changes in how they approached heart transplantation. And obviously, from the institutional point of view, it appeared to be favorable. Clearly small numbers, so analyzing results is difficult in a small study. But I liked it, and I thought you might like to know about it. Also this week, there was a really comprehensive statement from the American Heart Association on drug-induced arrhythmias. And it's a long document. It's very well done. But I just wanted to focus a little bit on the torsade de pointe, because torsade is kind of in the news with the COVID-19 pandemic. There are a number of drugs that cause torsade, and you can find these online. The Arizona Center for Education and Research on Therapeutics maintains an up-to-date list on QTC prolonging drugs. You're aware that chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin are known to cause torsade, especially in combination, and we've seen some reports in the COVID literature. There are other drugs used for COVID-19 that also can do this. This drug, lopinavir-ritonavir combination, can lengthen the QT as well. Recall that both typical and atypical antipsychotic agents can do it. So can fluoroquinolones and macrolide antibiotics. All of these have been associated with torsade and or sudden death. Risk factors for torsade de pointe and sudden death include a baseline QTC more than 500 milliseconds, or if the QTC extends 60 milliseconds from pretreatment levels. Be aware, of course, that women are more likely to have this, people who are over the age of 65, resting bradycardia, and ischemic syndromes, of course, acute myocardial infarction or ischemia. And be aware, of course, that hypokalemia and hypomagnesemia can do it, and along with many others. Nearly 30% of patients who suffer drug-induced QT prolongation carry a mutation for one of the five major QT syndrome genes. But currently, genetic screening generally for these types of channelopathies is not recommended. In terms of mitigation, important would be to keep the potassium above 4 and the magnesium above 2 in patients you're treating with a drug that could potentially cause QT prolongation. And these patients should also have an electrocardiogram on a regular basis, probably every 3 to 6 months. So I thought that was an interesting part of this scientific statement, and I wanted to share it with you this morning. The last paper is related to COVID, and it's a study that asks the question, does measuring CRP, LDH, high-sensitivity troponin, or N-terminal pro-PNP, or D-dimer improve prognostication in COVID-19? And it was a single-center study of about 130 patients where they measured all of these biomarkers. They also used a risk discriminator, which is clinical. It's called the National Early Warning Score, NEWS. And they looked at whether or not adding the biomarkers significantly improved prognostication. The mean age of the patient was 60. About 61% were men. 60% had at least one comorbidity. And most commonly, that was hypertension. 31% of patients met the primary endpoint, which was either hospital mortality or mechanical ventilation for at least 24 hours. All of the biomarkers were associated with an elevated risk. But when they actually did a multivariable model, including them with the NEWS score, which is a clinical score, they did not appear to add significant prognostication on the receiver operating curve. So this is an interesting analysis. It's a small study, but it just illustrates the fact that when we try to add biomarkers to risk prognostication, we have to be very careful with how we approach that. First of all, an ideal biomarker study in COVID-19 would be a large sample of patients presenting with a similar clinical syndrome. And then the question would be, could the biomarkers help us triage? And this might relate to sending them home. It might relate to likelihood of needing an ICU, so intensifying nursing care, et cetera. But we continue to learn as the COVID-19 pandemic goes on, and we certainly want to learn more about the value of biomarkers and where we should use them. Well, I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. The COVID-19 material is there on the COVID-19 hub, and we have all kinds of information there for you. I hope you'll refer to it. I hope that you have a very safe and healthy week, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. This is Kim Eagle for acc.org, and I'm out.